fictitious rhyming stories of a character's exploits. As the 70s turned into the 80s, disco, raunchy comedy records, and rap all began to merge, and it can be hard to tell the difference. In this vein, an argument could be made that the first West Coast gangster rap song is an obscure 1980 track called Bad Man Dan Rap, a tale of crazed sex, homosexuality, prostitution, and violence. Its sing-songy rap is performed by King Monkey, the alias of comedian Jimmy Thompson. But it, like most early hip-hop, lacked the hard, percussion-driven sound we came to associate with rap. That would dominate after Run-DMC helped change things with their 1983 song, Sucker MCs, which popularized a sparse drum machine beat that sounded great out of boomboxes. Run-DMC weren't gangsta rappers, but they influenced the man credited with launching the gangsta sound, Philadelphia's Schoolie D. Born Jesse Bonds Weaver Jr., he was raised in West Philadelphia as one of nine kids and witnessed a pair of murders growing up. An intimidating presence, he wrote, performed, and pressed up his own records, once brandishing a firearm at a record plant employee he accused of bootlegging his work. The protagonist of his 1984 track, Gangster Boogie, deals weed, macks the ladies, and flashes his 8mm at a would-be jacker. But the song Schoolie D released the next year, called PSK, What Does It Mean?, is considered the first gangster rap song. PSK shouts out Schoolie D's neighborhood gang, Parkside Killers, and follows the exploits of a local troublemaker who's driving around town smoking weed and drinking beer. Got to the place and who did I see? A sucker-ass nigga trying to sound like me. Put my pistol up against his head and said, you sucker-ass nigga, I should shoot you dead. Schoolie D didn't initially feature such strong language in his songs, but began gaining attention for his music when he started talking the way people talk on the streets, he said. PSK became a phenomenon. It's got an eerie lo-fi quality, with huge drums and vicious scratching reverberating as if throughout a cavernous hall. My jaw dropped, wrote Ice-T about the first time he heard it. I turned to my homie and said, yo, this shit is so dusted. It sounded different than regular hip-hop. It sounded like you were high. PSK inspired Ice-T's Six in the Morning, which sounds even more like the tough hip-hop to come. Produced by the unknown DJ, an enigmatic early world-class Wrecking Crew member who refused to let anyone take his picture, it succeeds through its details. Our hero's squeaking Adidas, his plush truck, his associate's chiming pager, the march of the battering ram. Got a knot in my pocket weighing at least a gram. Gold on my neck, my pistol's close at hand. I'm a self-made monster of the city streets, remotely controlled by hard hip-hop beats. I rap about what I know, Ice-T said in 1986. If I grew up in a nice neighborhood and lived in a $500,000 house, I'd be rapping about gold, silverware, and maids. But I didn't. I grew up in South Central L.A. At the time he recorded Six in the Morning, Ice-T actually was living in Hollywood, but he remained Adidas-clad, thin, and a bit paranoid, with submachine guns hanging on his apartment wall as a form of decoration. The song was a revelation. When Ice-T performed it at a South Bronx movie house in 1986, it went over like gangbusters with New York kingmakers Rakim and KRS-One. It shocked people when he said, we beat the bitch down in the goddamn street, said Africa Islam, another Ice-T producer. Back then, people didn't associate Los Angeles with hood stories. We thought it was all Hollywood and Malibu Beach. Ice-T would be the first rapper signed to Sire Records, Madonna's label. Meanwhile, in 1987, KRS-One, Scott LaRock, and D-Nice, together Boogie Down Productions, released an early classic gangster album, Criminal Minded. It featured The Bridge Is Over, championing their home turf of the South Bronx as the birthplace of hip-hop and dissing Queensbridge rapper MC Shan and his Juice Crew. Other artists from the era also get credit for pushing the boundaries of what could be said on record, like New York rapper Just Ice, known for his 1986 track Gangster of Hip Hop, and Oakland rapper Too Short, whose Freaky Tales is a pimp-influenced 1987 account of an insatiable harem. In Los Angeles, Compton impresario Mixmaster Spade was an early archetype for Eric Wright, both as a musician and a businessman. Led by songs like PSK and Six in the Morning, street-centric hip-hop was emerging as a plausible alternative to soft electro, and the new sound did not escape the notice of Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, and Eric. "These were the only records we were playing, because they were saying things we could relate to," said Dre. Tired of all the bland crooning and wimpy party raps on the radio, he and Eric wanted to use the language of the streets to tell tales as rough and wild as their daily life. In 1986, they started getting together at Lonzo's house, often accompanied by a songwriter named Laylaw Goodman, the other money man Dre had linked up with to help get his music made. He was known simply as Laylaw, a real street dude with cash to spare, owing to his other profession, the drug business. Eric, in fact, sometimes obtained dope on consignment from him. Cube also came with Dre to Lonzo's house, and he and Eric began getting to know each other. One day Dre played the guys his latest track. It featured a pared-down, menacing beat with 808 bass and a long electro fade-out. But there was also something gleeful and sadistic about it, a high-pitched keyboard riff that was immediately catchy. "What Dre wanted to do," wrote Los Angeles Times' Jonathan Gold, who interviewed him in this era, "was to create a signature, a sound so distinctive that he'd always know when people were bumping one of his tracks in their cars." Cube insisted he had the perfect song for the beat, hard-edged like Easy was interested in for his label. Called The Boys in the Hood, it was an epic tale modeled after Six in the Morning. The song's young protagonist is drunk on malt liquor, prone to slapping girlfriends and murdering thieves. Its local references include the character's ride: "I pulled up in my 64 Impala and preferred malt liquor. From the eight ball, my breath starts stinking, and even the local paper. Little did he know I had a loaded 12 gauge, one sucker dead, LA Times front page." "Now that's the way I want the lyrics to sound," said Eric, who added some personal touches to the track, like a verse about his old drug runner JD who started smoking crack and stole Eric's radio. "The boy JD was a friend of mine till I caught him in my car trying to steal an Alpine." Cube recorded a demo version of himself rapping over Dre's beat, which Eric listened to on repeat while driving around in his Jeep. Eric paid Cube a couple $100s for the song, and then later, when it was blowing up, a Suzuki Sidekick. Their business arrangement was incredibly informal, which would later cause tension. But at the time, Cube didn't feel exploited. In fact, by not signing any paperwork, he unknowingly insulated himself. "I never signed my publishing away," he said. You turn this dude into a rapper. Dre met a group called HBO, aka Homeboys Only, who were from New York, but in 1986 were staying for a time in Southern California. They had a Run-DMC vibe, and he agreed to record them. But upon arriving to Lonzo's studio, they didn't stick around for long. Their main historic claim to fame nowadays is that they passed on the Boys in the Hood. They was like, "Yo, man, we ain't doing that song. That's a West Coast record," Dre said. They was like, "What are you talking about? What's a 6-4? Cube said. Having already booked the studio time, Dre and Eric weren't sure what to do. Dre suggested Eric rap the song. He'd memorized Cube's version, after all, and the song was more like his life than anyone else's. He was already a street cat, so why not play one on record? But Eric was timid. "Put your glasses on. Cut the lights down," said Dre, motioning to Eric's sunglasses. "Just do it." Eric gave it a go, but he clearly didn't know what he was doing. His delivery was clunky, his cadence and timing a disaster. But Dre was patient, taking the time to punch in each line. He'd have Eric rap a short bit, cruising down the street in my 6'4", rewind the tape, perform it again, and then stitch together the best takes. It took 8 or 9 hours, but was worth the wait. Dre's genius was recognizing that for all his faults, Eric had the goods to be a memorable rapper, a unique voice. Indeed, Eric's squeaky instrument turned out to be both terrifying and calming, foreign and immediately recognizable. "I looked at Dre in amazement, like, 'You turned this dude into a rapper,' said Cube. Still, Boys wasn't an immediate success. They weren't sure at first how to promote it. Some doubted it would work at all. A rapper who ran in their circles named MC Chip remembers being shocked after hearing it for the first time with all the cursing. You're thinking like, damn, how's he gonna get radio play? They would worry about that later. For the time being, now that he was a rapper, Eric needed a rap name. The genesis of the moniker Eazy-E is a bit unclear, but he started using it around this time. Cube says they conceived it at the studio. It sounded cool, and it really described him. Eazy's childhood friend Big A says a pair of music industry brothers, he can't remember their names, gave it to him. He was sitting in their office chair, and they said, 'You really take life easy. You're an easy kind of guy,' Big A said. JD from The Lynch Mob speculates Eazy may have gotten it from the 1984 song Big Mouth by Houdini, of whom Eazy was a fan. The track concerns a rumor that had been spread around town. Pam was overheard talking to her man. Pam told Cookie what she thought she heard, and somehow Eazy-E had got the word. Whatever the case, on his very first attempt, he'd made rap history. The line, "cruising down the street in my 6'4", created gangsta rap, said Terrence Punch Henderson, the president of the label responsible for Kendrick Lamar. Makola. "I was very blue-eyed," Don McMillan said. "I trusted everybody." Perhaps that's why in 1986, he welcomed a Compton drug dealer to Makola, his record-pressing plant. The first thing McMillan, then in his 50s, noticed about Eazy-E, 3 decades his junior, was how short he was. Then he realized that the room had emptied out. The other artists who were there to talk business had suddenly vanished. "He's dangerous," someone told him later. "You don't even want to talk to him," said someone else. "This guy will shoot you if he looks at you." Don himself found Eazy exceedingly pleasant, and in any case, Eazy was there on legitimate business. He wanted the boys in the hood pressed up. McMillan was an unlikely hip-hop champion. Born in Victoria, British Columbia, as a young man, he drove a tugboat along the Pacific coast, pulling oil and gas barges to service logging camps and villages. He arrived in Los Angeles in 1960. But by the time Eazy-E came knocking, he was a white-haired family man who lived in suburban Palos Verdes estates and enjoyed golf. Don had developed ties with the black music community in the 60s and 70s while working at a vinyl pressing plant called Cadet on South Normandy Avenue. The South Central spot made records for artists like Ike and Tina Turner, Etta James, and B.B. King. In 1983, after Cadet folded, McMillan bought Makola during a fire sale and brought with him some of Cadet's artists and employees. Though compact discs would soon take off, cassettes and vinyl still had a bit more life in them. McMillan and his employees tended to vinyl presses and shrink-wrapping machines in the small bare-bones plant on a dodgy stretch of Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood that they shared with gangs and male prostitutes. The cluttered plant had ashtrays strewn about and cardboard boxes everywhere, records going out, records being returned. Wearing slacks and a collared sports shirt, a cigarette on his lips, Don gave artists a certain amount of time to collect their records that hadn't sold. But if they didn't, beware. That vinyl was headed straight to the grinder to be pressed into something else. By the mid-80s, McCullough was doing great business with self-starting black artists from south of downtown. What made McCullough perfect for their needs was that it was a printing plant, record label, and distributor all in one. Why wait for a major record label to discover you when you could get your own professional-looking album on the cheap? $1,000 got you 500 records, with Macmillan taking a percentage of sales in exchange for distribution. It was a fair trade. Macmillan had connections with record stores supplying distribution networks around the country, including with Memphis-based Selecto Hits, whose co-owner Johnny Phillips' Uncle Sam discovered Elvis. And so a rapper could bring in his music one day and quite possibly have a hit on his hands soon after. McCullough was an open-door policy, said McCullough promoter Ray Kennedy. A lot of people were coming in who normally wouldn't get a chance. Macmillan's somewhat ad hoc business model hit pay dirt with Greg Broussard, a.k.a. DJ Egyptian Lover, a breakout star from Uncle Jam's Army, the popular L.A. DJ crew who already had their own McCullough vinyl, Dial-A-Freak. Broussard came in to press up his robotic 12-inch 1984 record, Egypt, Egypt, and returned for 500 more copies, and then 500 more. He was selling them himself, out of his car's trunk, at swap meets, wherever, and Don asked to get in on the action, seeding the work through his distribution channels. For Egyptian Lover's full-length On the Nile album shoot, Macmillan costumed Broussard and rented the necessary Egyptian memorabilia, according to a news account, which is hilarious to imagine. Macmillan soon took his entrepreneurship to the next level by signing Two Live Crew, then a Riverside, California-based trio of Air Force Reserve men riding the electro wave. Their McCullough single, The Revelation, Two Live, gained popularity in South Florida, and so at the invitation of a DJ named Luke Campbell, they performed in Miami and eventually moved there. After Campbell joined the group himself and raunchily recast their image, they broke nationally, going on to define the Southern rap sound and soundtrack countless hot tub parties. McCullough eventually released records from a who's who of important California artists, including MC Hammer, Too Short, Ice-T, and Digital Underground. Their R&B electro group, Timex Social Club, broke into Billboard's top 10 with their song, Rumors. The whole time, Macmillan didn't know the LA hip-hop scene from Adam. He couldn't tell a good record from a bad record, at least as far as rap goes, said Macmillan's lawyer Gerald Weiner. His talent was timing, and he was smart enough to let his distributors and vendors tell him what to push. Still, some found his business dealing shady. Egyptian Lover, Arabian Prince, Roger Clayton, and others accused him of bootlegging albums, printing up extra copies, selling them secretly, and then keeping the proceeds for himself. I would imagine Don was selling records out the back door, said Chuck Fassard, marketing and sales manager at McCullough. A number of Macmillan's associates added that he had ties with a nefarious crew back east who helped promote world-class Wrecking Crew's hit, Turn Off the Lights. The crew's Lonzo Williams described getting a call from a man with a New York accent who accused him of improperly licensing Turn Off the Lights. He said, if you were in New York, they'd find you in the Hudson River. Macmillan denied all impropriety and any associations with intimidations. The idea that Don somehow didn't treat people fairly, it's just BS in my opinion, said his lawyer Gerald Weiner, adding, I will say that I think his accounting department was abysmal. I think if you asked Don at any one moment how many records he'd sold, he wouldn't know. When I visited him at his Palos Verdes Estates home in March 2015, Macmillan did not dispute this characterization. Now in his 80s, his memory is fading, and he gets around slowly. His right leg was amputated below the knee after an artery burst. He insists he gave his artists a fair deal, producing old contracts to bolster his case. Eazy-E and rapper Rendezvous, for example, signed a deal for a record containing The Boys in the Hood, Fat Girl, and other tracks, which paid them a $1,000 advance. Any proceeds were to be split 50-50 after McCullough took 15% of gross receipts as a distribution fee. It doesn't sound like a horrible deal, though without strict accounting, the terms wouldn't have mattered much. Whatever the case, Macmillan undoubtedly helped push these records out into the world. The successful artists usually left to make millions for other labels.
He was a really nice guy, said Doug Young,
a record promoter who had an office at the McCullough plant.
That, I think, was in over his head.
Ruthless. Using his drug-dealing profits, Easy had 10,000 12-inch vinyl copies of Boys pressed up at McCullough in early 1987. The vinyl listed his parents' home address on South Muriel Drive and credited Easy's new label, Ruthless Records. I'd been told the imprint was originally going to be called Rock House Records, another name for a dope house. But rapper Yomo, who later signed to Ruthless along with a partner named Malky, takes credit for its ultimate moniker, which he said he came up with after seeing a newspaper ad for Danny DeVito and Bette Midler's 1986 movie, Ruthless People. Easy and his crew brought stacks of Boys to record stores and swap meets. On weekends, they handed out free cassettes on Crenshaw Boulevard, the spot where kids showed off their lowriders. The buzz was palpable, but reports about its initial sales vary. I've read it sold as many as 200,000 copies in its first months, but no one really knows. One important champion was a local white woman, a hip-hop enthusiast in her early 30s named Violet Brown. She was the director of urban music at Warehouse Records, a chain with some 1,600 stores at the height of its popularity. Under her direction, Warehouse was the first major retailer to stock Boys.
You knew by listening to it what would happen with the record. It caught fire very quick, she said.
She put Easy's music in stores nationwide. This was rare at the time for West Coast acts, but that was changing. Los Angeles upstart label Delicious Vinyl kicked off in 1987 and soon hit with baritone rapper Tone Loc, a former gang member turned pop rapper with hits like Wild Thing and Funky Cold Medina. They also had Young MC, a Queens-reared USC grad with smart, inoffensive tracks like Bust a Move. These acts got play on K-Day, another crucial outlet for Boys. K-Day was the little station that could, broadcasting a muddy AM signal from six towers on a hill between Echo Park and Silver Lake. With call letters likely derived from its strictly daytime broadcast license upon its 1956 birth, it featured personalities such as Alan Freed and Art LeBeau in its early Top 40 days. Since its signals shot straight into South Central, it began playing black artists and even featured Rapper's Delight when it came out in 1979. Though K-Day is often described as the first station to play hip-hop 24/7, it always included R&B in the mix. In fact, a conservative program director took rap out of rotation in the early 80s, and it didn't return in force until the 1983 arrival of Greg McMillan, originally from Van Alstyne, Texas. Greg called himself Greg Mack and wore cowboy boots. He reminded Lonzo of Yosemite Sam. Upon arriving in L.A., he moved to South Central. All you had to do was listen to the cars driving by, and you could hear what people were into, Mack said. Attempting to jumpstart ratings, Mack put rap on heavy rotation, and it worked. Kids adjusted their antennas to pick up the signal, and Mack took his promotional efforts to the streets. He even began rubbing elbows with gangbangers. I created such a good rapport with these gang guys. They would call me at the station and tell me when someone got dusted, Mack said. He broadcast live from roller rinks, high schools, and clubs. Attempting to compete with Uncle Jam's army, he enlisted tastemaker DJs like Tony G, Julio G, and M-Walk, called Mixmasters, to perform at events, while Mack's own evening show, High Five, counted down the week's top five records. Between songs, high school kids called in to show off their rhyme skills and shout out their high schools. Crenshaw High, Lock High, Manual Arts. DJ Crazy Tunes, Ice Cube's DJ today, remembers listening to the countdowns. The next day, he and his brother Dub C would travel to one of the schools,
hop the fence, and commence lyrical and pop-locking battles over the lunch hour. K-Day also sent young rappers like Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Ice-T, MC Hammer, and Candyman out on promotional tours around the city. Community centers, shopping centers, schools. They wouldn't always perform, sometimes just sign autographs or play basketball with the kids. East Coast acts like Run-DMC, LL Cool J, and Big Daddy Kane were enlisted as well, in something of a strong-arm arrangement. Mac tended not to play you on the air unless you did concerts for his station. He attempted to appeal not just to young African-Americans, but Latinos, too, who made up almost half their audience, he said. K-Day was a godsend for the emerging local rap scene. K-Day was the one station you could make a record, walk through the door, hand it to them, and they'd put it on the air, said Ice-T. Right then. It was also an important community mouthpiece. Following the 1986 riot at the Run-DMC concert in Long Beach, the station held a day of peace, suspending their playlist to take calls and promote nonviolence. The guests included Run-DMC and singer Barry White, a former South Central gangbanger himself. Calls for a ceasefire were observed, at least temporarily. For all his vision, Greg Mack wasn't initially all that excited about boys, but he heard it every time he went out. And so, at his request, Easy made a clean version, and it became their most requested record. Suddenly, Boys was everywhere. Easy gave his first live show at Skateland on September 4th, 1987. CIA opened. He was nervous, but he needn't have been. The 800 or so kids in attendance knew Boys by heart and rapped it for him. Easy played down his gang affiliation for the concert, probably a smart move considering he was a Crip playing in a blood stronghold. Instead, he wore his typical street clothes, Raiders gear, jeans, Nikes. He had no idea he was creating a fashion template. Supergroup. Joseph Nazel edited important black publications like the Los Angeles Sentinel, as well as porn rags like Players. He wrote countless blaxploitation novels, with titles like My Name is Black. His musically inclined son Kim was raised in Compton and Inglewood and, like so many other kids in the early 80s, idolized Prince, so much so that he began dressing like the Minneapolis icon. He even called himself DJ Prince. But that all changed while roller skating one day with a friend. A cute girl skated up beside them and asked their names. I'm Egyptian Lover, said Nazel's friend, the popular DJ. I'm DJ Prince, said Nazel. The girl sized him up before coming up with her own Middle East-flavored moniker. You should be Arabian Prince, she said, since you're always with him. And so it was. Like his buddy, Arabian Prince released electro records with spacey exotic sounds befitting his name. Arabian Prince began encountering Dr. Dre on the local DJ circuit. Before long, they were shopping for records at Rhodium, hitting the beach, and chasing women together. They'd even drive all the way out to San Bernardino County to visit members of a saucy, charismatic group of female rappers called JJ Fad. Dre's love interest was Anna Cash, a.k.a. Lady Anna, while Arabian Prince's love interest was Juana Burns, a.k.a. MCJB. The girls wanted to make a record, but Dre wasn't feeling it. He was like, this is corny, remembered MCJB, then a cheerleader for the Los Angeles Express, part of the short-lived United States Football League. But Arabian Prince had some studio time at his disposal, and so he helped the ladies put together a pair of tracks called Supersonic and Another Hoe Bites the Dust. The latter is a little-remembered entry in the mid-80s, Roxanne Wars, a series of verbal volleys sparked by a dispute between MC Roxanne Shanté and the group UTFO, who made the song Roxanne Roxanne. Despite the fact that JJ Fad didn't know the players involved or have any reason to be upset with them, they threw out their best insults, Roxanne Shante ain't got no hair in her back. She's bald.
At that time, if you didn't have a diss record, you didn't have anything, said MCJB.
The track didn't go anywhere, but its contagious B-side, Supersonic, began to make some noise. Eazy-E saw them perform it at local club, The Casa, and left impressed. Meanwhile, Eazy courted Arabian Prince for a supergroup he was planning of his own, which also included Cube, from CIA, and Dr. Dre and DJ Yella, from World Class Wrecking Crew. Though he had a hot single, Eazy was still unconfident in his rapping abilities, and likely thought it best to surround himself with a group of ringers. It was good timing. Dre and Cube had outgrown their old acts, and so the group, along with Eazy's buddy from the neighborhood, MC Ren, met at Arabian Prince's mother's house on Van Ness Avenue in Inglewood. The plan was to come up with a name. Despite Eazy and Dre's inclinations, it wasn't a foregone conclusion they'd be hardcore. After all, three of their original members, DJ Yella, Ice Cube, a.k.a. Purple Ice, and Arabian Prince, a.k.a. DJ Prince, idolized Prince. One thing they quickly agreed on, they wanted to represent where they were from, just like the New York rappers who shouted out their boroughs. Arabian Prince jokingly imagined a cover where the guys were holding guns with the title, From Compton with Love. That idea didn't go over so well. Eventually, he and Dre began complaining about not getting paid for their production credits. I feel like a nigga with an attitude, someone said. And before long, Eazy suggested, N.W.A. Niggas with Attitudes. It was a moniker shocking enough to turn heads, with a soupçon of righteous indignation. Cube, told of it later, was definitely down. Black people taking that word and trying to use it, instead of getting abused by it. It's a genius moniker in its provocativeness, thrilling some and making others uncomfortable. In early interviews, MC Ren took full advantage of the disparity, goading reporters, including me, into repeating a word many of them simply were incapable of even stammering, wrote Jonathan Gold. If you rose to the bait, you were a racist. If you didn't, I didn't. You were a wuss. There was no middle ground. Eazy was in charge of the group's decision-making. By now, he'd quit the drug game entirely and divided his time between his own solo projects and N.W.A. The group's first EP, Panic Zone, released in 1987, contains two songs that have gone down in history and one that hasn't. Eight Ball is an ode to Old English 800 malt liquor. I don't drink brass monkey, Eazy starts off the song, responding to the Beastie Boys' peeing for their preferred elixir. The song also samples the white New York acts, Fight for Your Right. Notably, neither Eazy nor the songs Scribe Ice Cube actually drank at the time. Sir Jinx said when Eazy toted a 40-ouncer during performances, it would actually be filled with apple juice. Like 8-Ball, Dope Man was written by Ice Cube, and it foreshadowed the group's sound and image to come. It's the first example of Dr. Dre's use of the Funky Worm, the high-pitched, irresistible Moog synthesizer sound whose name was coined by 70s funk group Ohio Players. Dope Man alternately glamorizes and condemns the pusher and his lifestyle, ending with a stern warning voiced by Mexican-American rapper Crazy D. You sold crack to my sister, and now she's sick, but if she happens to die because of your drug, I'm putting in your culo a 38 slug. N.W.A.'s first single was actually the electro-driven track, Panic Zone, an apocalyptic dispatch from L.A.'s tough neighborhoods. Ice Cube is from L.A., he's in the Panic Zone. Eazy-E is from Compton, he's in the Panic Zone. Arabian Prince from Inglewood, he's in the Panic Zone. Though it hit locally, the song is barely remembered today. Robotic vocals were already on the way out, displaced by, well, gangsta songs like The Boys in the Hood. To capitalize on N.W.A.'s emerging popularity, McCola put together an album called N.W.A. and the Posse. They did so without N.W.A.'s consent, however, creating a bizarre situation in which the group was bad-mouthing their own record. That shit was like some whack shit, MC Ren said. No matter its provenance, Posse actually succeeds as a pretty good compilation album of the group's early works, including the Panic Zone tracks, Boys, and gag songs like Fat Girl with Easy and Rendezvous, riffing on the Randy Rubenesque title character. Misogyny and humor commingle on A Bitch is a Bitch, in which Ice Cube denigrates girls who won't give him the time of day. I guarantee you we will be rich. Today, N.W.A. and the Posse is probably best known for its cover photo, an 80s time capsule featuring a dozen of the group's affiliates, mean mugging in a graffiti-covered trash-strewn Hollywood alleyway near McCola, 40-ounce bottles in hand. The record also introduced another extraordinary talent, Dallas rapper Tracy Curry, who performs on Posse with a group called the Fela Fresh Crew. Their contributions include the Ode to Liquor, Drink It Up, a boozy parody of Twist and Shout, and Dunk the Funk, a banger showing off Curry's dexterous rapping ability. Such lyrical acrobatics were unlike anything the West Coast had yet seen up to this point, and it turns out Curry was a master songwriter as well. Curry was introduced to N.W.A. via a Los Angeles DJ named Dr. Rock, an early member of the World Class Wrecking Crew. Dre had taken Rock's place in the group when the latter departed for college in Austin, and he later became an on-air personality for Dallas radio station K104. At a Dallas party, Rock happened upon Curry performing live. "I was blown away," Dr. Rock said. "I thought to myself, this is a guy I've got to get on wax." Curry originally called himself Doc because a rap partner's sister was a lab technician, and he thought he looked good in her coat. He later started calling himself D.O.C., adding the periods to connect himself with N.W.A. For the time being, however, he joined Dr. Rock and a friend named Fresh K in the Fela Fresh Crew. Dre, who recorded tracks with them, some of which ended up on N.W.A. and the Posse, was blown away. "He was like, nigga, you the shit," D.O.C. said. "If you come out to the West Coast, I guarantee you we will be rich." D.O.C. soon moved into a Compton house behind Centennial High School, owned by a Dallas acquaintance. Before long, however, Dre scraped enough money together to move out of Sir Jinx's house and into a two-bedroom apartment in the city of Paramount, just east of Compton. DJ Yella was his roommate, and they let D.O.C. crash on the floor of their unfurnished living room, where he didn't have so much as a sleeping bag. But despite the Spartan accommodations, the guys quickly bonded. "That was my first real connection with Dre, that we both liked to drink," D.O.C. said. In the mornings, they'd shake off the fog and drive into the studio in a battered Toyota Corolla, blasting Public Enemy. Their recording spot was the optimistically named Audio Achievement Studio in Torrance. Attached to a Mexican restaurant, it was owned by a genial long-haired recording engineer named Donovan the Dirt Biker Smith. At the studio, D.O.C. was quickly enveloped into the ruthless fold and became an unofficial member of N.W.A. His first task was writing lyrics for Eazy-E's solo song, We Want Easy. It was D.O.C., with help from MC Ren, who began fashioning Eazy into the bawdy gangster character we know today, and D.O.C. was a major writing contributor to Straight Outta Compton as well. It was ironic, really. Growing up in Texas, D.O.C. knew nothing about L.A. street culture. He used his naivete to his advantage. "When I first got to Los Angeles, hip-hop music was a scary thing not only to white America, but to middle-class black America. They were afraid of it. They thought it was nigger shit," D.O.C. said, adding that he used Eazy as a comedian similar to Public Enemy's Flavor Flav to deliver serious messages with humor. Eazy-E's character played off a long-established hood archetype, the heroic dealer surrounded by the finest trappings and women, conquering enemies, but never forgetting where he came from. His melodies were hummable, and his tongue was often in his cheek, as he rapped on, "No more questions about the way he conducted business. Walked in, said, this is a robbery.
Didn't need the money. It's just a hobby. Fill the bag, homeboy. Don't lag. I want money, beer, and a pack of zigzags.
NWA wasn't just the world's most dangerous group, as they branded themselves. They were also gangsters having fun. With the help of DOC and his songwriting, they became bad guys you couldn't help but root for. Chapter 5. I'm Not Giving You Shit. Mountain View Estates, a neighborhood of multi-million-dollar homes in the posh suburb of Calabasas, lies within the Santa Monica National Recreation Area. It's a 40-minute drive west from downtown L.A. if there's no traffic, although there always is. Only with an invitation is one permitted past the community's gates, but once the guard waves you through, you're greeted by a towering fountain shooting mist into the air. But for a gentle breeze, the sloping streets are still. Occasionally, a Lexus or Mercedes exits a driveway. On a bright afternoon in October 2014, few residents are enjoying their suburban splendor, though Central American workers are beautifying homes and grounds apace. In every direction, tiled roofs, wrought iron sculptures, and immaculately tended lawns, even during a drought. With its grandiose swimming setups and soulless architecture, Calabasas is where the rich and famous move to show off how much money they have. Mountain View Estates is just west of Hidden Hills, which has become especially well-known in recent years for famous residents including Kanye West and Kim Kardashian, Jennifer Lopez, and Drake. For months, I'd unsuccessfully pestered Jerry Heller for an interview. When I say I want to see the house where Eazy-E lived, two doors down from his own, to my surprise, he gives the guard my name. I take a few photos of Eazy's old pad, big pool, sweeping views, a whimsical statue of two boys on the lawn, one holding a violin, and Heller meets me in front of his three-car garage, which houses a Jaguar and a Volkswagen. Built in 1990, Heller's mock Mediterranean 5,000-square-foot house has a Spanish-style roof, big-picture window in front, and ornate balcony. We can talk, but no interview, the former NWA manager said in our email. Having no idea what this means, I follow him inside with a mixture of trepidation and curiosity. Everyone and their mother has an opinion about Jerry Heller. He's the subject of more diss tracks than anyone this side of Tipper Gore, and I'm curious to know him as a person. Now in his eighth decade, Heller wears the effects of time and a combative career. His face droops, his white hair has thinned, and he walks tentatively. Clad in white tennis shoes and a blue polo shirt, he immediately takes a call, leaving me to observe the contents of his living room. His table is piled with magazine articles about him and NWA, old world-class Wrecking Crew albums, and an early Eazy-E and Rendezvous record called L.A. Is the Place. The modern art on the walls looks expensive, and above the fireplace sits a picture of him and his blonde, bosomy, much younger ex-wife, Gail Steiner. They shared a passion for rescue dogs. Eventually, he winds up his conversation. We talk for a few minutes before he receives another call, something involving the director Jim Sheridan, who he says is slated to adapt his memoir, Ruthless, for film, before finally giving me his attention. Can I turn on my recorder? I ask at one point, to which he responds, I'm not giving you shit. He explains that constantly rerun television interviews he did years ago haven't paid him a dime, adding that previous book scribes have done him dirty. He unsuccessfully sued the author and publisher of the 1998 book, Have Gun Will Travel, about Death Row Records, which he felt unfairly portrayed him. He is also suing the makers of the 2015 biopic, Straight Outta Compton, for defamation. Alternately calm and heated, Heller oscillates between saying he doesn't care what anyone says about him and vehemently denying various allegations. I eventually wrangle some quotes on the record from him, as well as lots of great background information, and leave the premises thinking him simultaneously cold and quite generous. When my grandmother died a year later, he expressed his condolences on my Facebook page. This is Heller in a nutshell. More than anyone else in this book, people split right down the middle on him. Many ruthless records insiders assert his critical role in the development of its artists. There's a reason they say that N.W.A. became an international phenomenon, while other gangster rappers of the era didn't break big. Others practically spit at the mention of his name. N.W.A. affiliate turntablist DJ Speed called him, to me, a crook, and to Hip Hop DX, a snake. Heller retorted by calling Speed a gopher. He took Eric's laundry in. When Heller appeared on the Murder Master Music Show internet radio program in 2013, a caller referred to him as a Shylock. He returned to the podcast a year later, and a different listener called him a Shylock again. Ice Cube famously used anti-Semitic language toward Heller when things soured between them. But in the early days, at least to many artists he courted, his background seemed to imply an ability to make it rain. He was a white Jewish dude that knew people, and he could get into record companies that we couldn't get into, Arabian Prince said. It was hard enough getting money out of our own banks. There's one thing no one disagrees about. With Heller's help, Ruthless Records went from a regional homegrown success to a national powerhouse. Heller's father owned a scrap metal business. He loved gambling on sports and hung out with the Jewish mob, eventually landing the family in wealthy Cleveland suburb Shaker Heights. As one of the town's few Jews, Heller felt like an outsider, he wrote in Ruthless. After receiving a business degree from USC, he reached great heights in the music industry in the 60s and 70s, acting as agent for artists like Marvin Gaye and Creedence Clearwater Revival, bringing Elton John and Pink Floyd across the pond for their first American tours, and serving as mentor to famed music manager Irving Azoff. Heller also promoted electronic music pioneers Kraftwerk's first U.S. tour in 1975. Along the way, he partied like the rock stars he accompanied. But Heller fell off his game in the new wave era. In 1985, he was divorced and sleeping on his parents' sofa in Encino when he received a call from his friend, music manager Maury Alexander, who'd been hip to the goings-on at Mercola. Heller met with Don McMillan and Rudy Party, one half of L.A. Dream Team, who played Heller the group's hot electro hip-hop single, The Dream Team Is in the House. Heller agreed to help manage the group and was also impressed with J.J. Fad, who were on the Dream Team's label. After being rear-ended on the freeway and receiving a settlement, Heller moved out of his mother's house, bought a condo in the Simi Valley, and plunged into L.A. urban music in earnest. He hawked records at the Rhodium and agreed to manage acts like the World Class Wrecking Crew and CIA. In the mid-80s, Heller often used to sit in Mercola's lobby and try to pick up artists to offer his services as manager, Don McMillan said. Heller hooked up with rappers and DJs whose talents, he believed, weren't being properly utilized. I recall, at least a couple of times, producers singing the praises of recording equipment that they had purchased from Toys R Us for $200, he wrote. His reputation was that of a mover and shaker from a previous era. Easy, in particular, was dying to meet him, so much so that he paid Alonzo Williams to make the introduction. Which is why on the morning of March 3, 1987, Eazy-E arrived in front of Mercola in his burgundy Suzuki Samurai with MC Ren in tow. Eazy was dressed to impress. Lokes, brand new low-cut Converse All-Stars, immaculate white t-shirt, and a gold watch you could tell was real, remembered promoter Doug Young. Young was there for the meeting, too. He had never met Eazy, but his reputation preceded him. How do you know it's them? Heller asked Young, watching from afar as Eazy and Ren came in. Because they look like two gangbangers, Young replied. Lonzo made the introductions, upon which time Eazy retrieved the cash from his sock to pay him for the service. They proceeded to McMillan's office, where the conversation was a bit awkward. Heller asked Eazy if he was the dope man in the song. Easy went silent, but Heller continued prying.
I got a money tree in my backyard,
Easy said finally. This loosened everyone up, and Easy went on to explain that he wanted his new group NWA to sound tough.
They're going to be hip-hop. They're going to be real street with it, he went on. But they're going to represent the way that we talk in L.A., the way that we act in L.A. They're going to promote the L.A. culture.
Heller soon warmed to the group's music, particularly the Boys in the Hood. He and Easy decided to go into business together, and they soon met at Cahuenga Boulevard restaurant, Martoni's. Also there were Heller's partner, Maury Alexander, and the other McCullough artists they were working with, including Rodney O and Joe Cooley, Rudy Pardee, Russ Parr, The Unknown DJ, Alonzo Williams, Arabian Prince, and Egyptian Lover. There was friction about Heller's increasingly close ties to Easy, whose coarse style was disliked by some of his other clients. According to Heller's account of the evening, he announced he'd thrown his lot in with Easy's upstart label, and that anyone who didn't join him there would need new representation. Alonzo Williams, however, said just the opposite, that artists, including Pardee and Unknown DJ, gave Heller the ultimatum. It's either us or Easy. Whatever the case, Heller and many of his artists parted ways. Heller's decision to team up with Easy was hastily made. Heller said Easy offered him 50% of Ruthless, but he insisted on taking only a 20% fee.
Every dollar comes into Ruthless, I take 20 cents, he said he told Easy. You own the company. I work for you.
Heller would also manage a number of Ruthless acts, including NWA. But Easy was the principal decision maker. Arabian Prince decided to join the Ruthless crew, but he soon grew skeptical about Heller's proposed arrangement. For one thing, you didn't want your manager and your label's manager to be the same person. When it's time to negotiate, after all, you need someone looking out for your interests and your interests only. Such an arrangement is not particularly unusual in hip-hop, but it is also not ethical, said David Cronemeyer, an industry analyst and former senior vice president at Atlantic Records. The artist might want tour support from the label or a video, or to focus on certain markets where the act is strong. The record company might have a different position on all of these issues. Heller responded that he didn't manage all of Ruthless's acts, but when he did, he was always on the side of the artist, so any conflict would have been on his side. He added that in these cases, he only took a single commission and never double-dipped. Heller and Easy's relationship would represent the backbone of Ruthless Records. It was a complicated one. Some still don't understand it today, and many tried to get between them.
People calling me asking me, why you got a white man as your manager? Easy said. It's like, when I was looking for a manager, I closed my fucking eyes and I said, I want the best. Jerry happened to be the best.
Their relationship was also personal. Heller helped Easy get his first driver's license and set up his first bank account. Easy helped Heller find a renewed purpose.
Easy loved his dad, but they didn't communicate a lot, said Cherise Henry, who later became Easy's personal assistant.
While Easy's father, Richard, was introverted,
Jerry was like an active father to him. He would say, Jerry's like a dad to me.
Dre, focused on music, wasn't much involved with the logistics of setting Ruthless up as a business, but he was initially impressed with Heller as well, owing to the time the manager helped the world-class Wrecking Crew procure some money they were owed from their record label. One of Easy and Heller's first decisions was to sign JJ Fad. It paid quick dividends. Having heard their songs recorded by Arabian Prince, Dr. Dre no longer thought they were corny. He reworked Supersonic and co-produced their debut album of the same name, featuring a reshuffled lineup. Easy intended Ruthless to be the hardest label on the block, but putting out a PG-rated group first made sense.
Jerry and Eric were like, we need to come out as a legitimate record label, so let's put out the girls first, said MCJB. Warner subsidiary Atco Records signed on to distribute the work, which went gold. Supersonic became a huge breakout hit in the wake of Salt-N-Pepa's 1988 smash, Push It. J.J. Fad and N.W.A. performed at a charity party for underprivileged children at the L'Hermitage Hotel in Beverly Hills on Valentine's Day, 1988. It was hosted by hunk Scott Valentine, who played Mallory Keaton's bad boy boyfriend on Family Ties. N.W.A. performed a kid-friendly song. No one can remember exactly what. But J.J. Fad was the main attraction to the teeny boppers. Supersonic was even nominated for a 1989 Grammy for Best Rap Performance, the first year it was given out. J.J. Fad wore custom-made tuxedos with miniskirts to the ceremony. Unfortunately, because that particular award wasn't televised, other nominees including Salt-N-Pepa and eventual winner DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince boycotted the ceremony. Learning the techniques and terminology. Despite J.J. Fad's success, neither Atco nor any other major labels were interested in N.W.A., whose sound and image seemed much riskier. And so, with the group's future in doubt, upon his graduation from high school in 1987, Ice Cube made other plans. Following the advice of a Taft teacher, he took the train to Arizona and spent a year studying architectural drafting, receiving a certificate from the now-defunct Phoenix Institute of Technology. The other N.W.A. members kept plugging, but Cube decided to follow his hip-hop backup plan. He remembers a grueling schedule and work that demanded intense concentration. Architectural drafting is all about precision and learning the techniques and terminology to try to put it to use, he said. The drawings got progressively harder and harder as the year went on. He credits the experience with helping him learn to live on his own. He still worked on rap with his friend Phoenix Phil's crew, though they didn't really go anywhere. He missed his friends back home. I get calls from them. We're about to go to Chicago. Then we fly to Atlanta, he said. And here I have 6 months of school left. That was the worst year of my life. My dreams were leaving me behind. In Cube's wake, MC Ren stepped up. Like the departed rapper, he was a bit younger than the other group members. His older brother was friends with Easy, and the two families lived only 2 blocks apart in Compton. As a kid, Ren was a disciple of DMC, not Run like most, and, like Easy, Crip-affiliated. He'd been accidentally shot in a random act of gangland violence. As his rap talents developed, he joined a beatboxing friend named Chip in a duo called Awesome Crew 2. The underage performer scored a show at Sunset Strip Club, the Roxy. Realizing Ice-T was in attendance, their heart rates quickened. He was in the process of putting together his Rhyme Syndicate label, which would include artists like rapper Everlast and the duo Low Profile. Unfortunately, Ren recalled, the whole thing went awry. The DJ got the tempo wrong at one point, throwing off their whole rhythm. We had to rap so fast, it was fucked up, Ren said. Then after we came off the stage, Ice-T said, nice. The tone, unfortunately, was pure sarcasm. Ren nearly enlisted in the army, but couldn't leave hip-hop behind. He dazzled Easy with freestyles in the latter's stucco-detached garage, which had evolved into a modest practice space with turntables, drum machines, and a stand-up Asteroids video game console. Ren was a pure spitter, capable of dominating the beat with a little extra mustard. Easy signed him to a solo deal, but soon realized his strengths as a ghostwriter. Ren penned the tracks Easy Does It, Radio, and Ruthless Villain, which eventually ended up on Easy's 1988 solo album, Easy Does It. But the pace of Ruthless Villain proved too quick for Easy's meager rapping skills. So Dre was like, man, just let Ren say the rap, Ren remembered. He was soon invited to join N.W.A.
NWA's first-ever show was at Skateland on March 11, 1988.
My homeboy Eazy-E and the whole NWA posse is in effect, said MC Ren,
giving shout-outs between Eazy's Boys